First case is Arnold Keith Anderson v. State, case number 74076. And Justice Silver, if you would take it away.
Thank you. If you could please state your name for the record for my clerk, and also let us know how much time you might need for any rebuttal argument.
Okay, thank you. May it please the court, Justice Silver, Justice Stiglitz, Justice Hardesty, I am Lisa Rasmussen, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Anderson. I will reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal argument with the court's pleasure.
Sure.
So I'm going to go a little bit backwards here. I think I didn't do this case, and I'm stepping in for the appellate lawyer who did the briefing. I've reviewed everything, including a very extensive appendix in this case. But it seems to me that the right to counsel is probably the most substantive issue. But sometimes when I get going on those issues and with the questions, I have very little room at the end to address the other two remaining issues. So I'm actually going to start with those and just mention a couple things that I think are important to add on issues 2 and 3 and then go to the right to counsel issue. With regard to issue number 2, this is the right to confrontation argument that was made in the brief. I think there's a couple things that are important for the court to put in context when evaluating that claim. One is that the alleged conversation that the state introduced as a mechanism to sort of void or have the defendant forfeit his right to confrontation is a conversation that occurred way in the beginning of his incarceration, prior to even the preliminary hearing. And not only was that conversation very early on in his incarceration, not in anywhere near the context of the actual trial date, it was a conversation that was not disclosed by the state until trial. Basically, it was disclosed by the state during the trial. And I thought that that was important. I think that's important for the court to understand.
The state makes the representation, though, and the transcript reflects on that particular argument. They actually advised the court, though, that it was like the day before.
The conversation from my review, yes, and I saw that, but it appears from the actual
the investigator's testimony?
Yeah, the investigator's testimony that the conversation was like 2 days after he had been incarcerated, which is arguably prior to even the preliminary hearing. I think that what happened was the investigator may have pulled the conversation, so that may be why it was introduced at trial, but the conversation itself was old. And I thought that that was an important point.
Well, Ms. Rasmussen, which conversations are you referring to? Because as I understood it, there were two jail telephone calls between the defendant and a third party. One was, you know, previous, and then one was in the middle of the trial. Which conversation are you referring to? Are you referring to the defendant's conversations?
The defendant's conversations that were introduced as the mechanism to prevent him from being able to allege his right under the Confrontation Clause.
So there's only one jail call, because what the state represents to Judge Leavitt when they're making that motion is that the jail call occurred in the middle of trial, like literally the day before.
Right, and that's not the case. The jail call actually, so he testified during the middle of trial, and I think he had maybe pulled, and in my experience that's consistent, detectives will often pull jail calls right before trial or sometimes during. He had pulled it perhaps during trial, and pulling it means that you go to the database and find it, but that the conversation itself was actually early on in his incarceration. And I think that that's set forth in the brief, but I don't think that it's highlighted, and I thought that that was an important point.
I'm sorry, Mr. Rasmussen, it is an important point, so just to go back to that, the transcript from August 29th, 2017 said that they received it, that he had made a call to his daughter. Earlier yesterday, it had been represented the state intended to call the daughter as a rebuttal witness. Then today, the defendant was recorded calling his daughter and telling her to disappear. Then they reference a previous call from August 3rd, which is the birthday, a birthday at least affiliated with that. So those facts matter, so maybe we can clear it up when the state comes up.
Okay.
Not sure.
And I may be wrong from my read of the record. My read of the record was that the conversation was pulled, but that it had taken place much earlier.
And when you say the conversation, you're talking about the one where supposedly the defendant says skedaddle out
of
here.
Don't come to court.
Right, not the birthday, but the skedaddle out of here was really not the day before. It was pulled the day before. But that particular phone call where he's telling her to leave, leave and get out of here is really, that occurred soon after his arrest, is what you're saying.
Correct. That is, and that was my understanding.
And that's based on the investigator's testimony.
Right.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, and so then issue three, I think this is an interesting issue, but I again, and I don't want to say I would have characterized it differently, but to me, the battery is clearly a lesser included offense of the attempted murder. And I think the state indicated, and the court even indicated to the defendant early on in this case, well before trial, these are alternate theories. You aren't going to be sentenced on both of them. You're not going to be subject to punishment on both of them. And the state indicated that they were alternate charging theories, which I think they clearly are. They're clearly a single act. This is one of those situations where I have to comment on kind of the abuse of discretion on the part of the prosecutors. Can they seek a sentence on both, can they seek a conviction on both? Can they seek a jury instruction on both? Absolutely they can. Can they seek a sentence on both? They can, but should they? Should they is the issue. Because it is a single act. There's no dispute that it's a single act. And there's also no dispute under the facts of this case that the battery is clearly a lesser included offense of the attempted murder. And there could be, there are myriad circumstances where an attempt murder and a battery could have different fact patterns. Somebody could not make contact, you know, if you don't actually hit them with a bullet, that's not a battery. It could be an assault, but it's not a battery. In this case, there was a shooting, the bullets hit the person, there was a battery with a deadly weapon, and there was an attempt murder. But does it warrant punishment on both acts? And I would submit to the court that it doesn't.
Well, doesn't,
and
Jack,
I, and
doesn't
I, well,
Ms. Rasmussen, I'm sorry, doesn't Jackson versus State, you know, or 128 Nevada 598 stand for the proposition that we can do that very thing?
It does, Justice Stiglitz, and I read it, and it clearly is on point. I'm not disputing that it's on point, but I think it's my obligation to point out that I think that it's an abuse of discretion for the state to seek multiple theories. For example, in a murder case, the state often has multiple theories of liability. They have a theory of felony murder, and they might have a premeditated murder theory, and the jurors convict, but we don't sentence them twice. And I understand the precedent in Jackson v. State. I understand this court's ruling in that case. But I think, you know, that addressed double jeopardy issues. That's addressed somewhat here in the brief. Units of prosecution are a term that's floated around here in the brief. But what it really is at its heart is a lesser included offense. And do we punish twice on a lesser included offense on the facts of this case? So I think it's an... Yes.
Go ahead, finish your thought, and then I'd like to return to issue number two, if I may.
Okay, Your Honor, no, I'm okay. Go ahead and return to issue number two.
Yeah, I regrettably, the video creates a delay in our being able to pose questions, and I apologize for that. But I wanted to address three questions concerning issue number two. At least for me, this issue was a key reason why the case should be argued today, and I appreciate you beginning by offering a clarification about when the call occurred. My question is this. Does it make a difference with respect to the doctrine of wrongdoing by forfeiture? This doctrine was presented for the first time to us on appeal as to whether Nevada should adopt the doctrine. It was used by the court in arriving at its conclusion about how to address the investigator's testimony. And then secondly, it plays an important role in determining whether we should employ the doctrine or make determinations under the doctrine under a preponderance of the evidence or by clear and convincing standard. And there are some important policy questions. So from your perspective on your client's behalf, what should the law be in this area, regardless of when the phone call took place?
So from my perspective, it should be a clear and convincing standard if the court is to adopt this concept of forfeiture. There are other areas that the court might gain guidance from where we employ similar concepts, and I think one of them, well, for example, if someone had been deposed and then didn't show up for the trial, the deposition could be used, but it couldn't be propounded by the person who created the unavailability, so to speak. So we already have these kind of doctrines and concepts out there, but I believe that the standard is clear and convincing on that, and I'm not sure that the court did that thorough of an analysis with regard to this. The court did take testimony from the investigator, but this situation was different, I have to add, because there was no prior testimony that was subject to cross-examination. This was just a detective saying this is what she said. There wasn't even a recorded statement. So it went a little bit beyond what you'd normally see, which would be prior testimony either at a prelim or even in a civil case context through deposition. There's all sorts of case law addressing those issues, but not specifically this, where it's not prior testimony subject to cross-examination. And I don't, the whole idea of it is if you procure the absence, then you don't get to benefit from the use of the prior testimony. But here we have, it's not testimony, it was a statement. And I think the real danger here was that we just had someone coming in and saying, this is what she told us in our office. So I agree with the court, it's problematic on many levels. If the court were to adopt such a rule for future cases, it should be a clear and convincing standard.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to, and I appreciate the court, letting me know that this was the issue that the court saw as important, so I'm actually glad I started there, although that's not why I started there. I'm going to go on to the right to counsel issue. I actually thought that this was...
2 minutes.
Okay.
Just to let you know, you won't have rebuttal left.
Oh, that's
right. You have 2 minutes. Yeah, you got 2.5 minutes.
Oh,
right,
I
now
thought that was out of my 10. Okay. No. All right, well then...
Is that right? Yeah, you've only got 2.5 minutes, so I just wanted to let you know.
Not
yeah.
7. Okay. All right, then I better jump to the right to counsel issue, and I'll save a minute if I can for rebuttal. On the right to counsel issue, I believe that the record is clear that he was not getting what he needed from his lawyer. I believe that the inquiry made by the district court was inadequate. I don't think that she went far enough in delving into what the conflict was, but the defendant himself made numerous representations. He wasn't getting discovery. He wasn't getting FaceTime with the lawyer. The investigator was sometimes delivering things to him. And the record is abundantly clear throughout, actually from January through June, of very specific things he had asked for. His request to represent himself is clearly an issue that he states, I'm only asking to represent myself because I don't have effective counsel. I think that there was a failure of counsel on this part. I think it's unfortunate, but I think the record is clear. And I think it would be easy for the court to say, well, he was representing himself. He doesn't have the right to the effective assistance of counsel. But really, he's only representing himself because he's not getting what he needs from a lawyer. And this was an instance where another lawyer should have been appointed. With that, I'll save my rebuttal, which I think is a minute and 13 seconds, and thank you for helping me keep time.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Binu Palal. I am with the Clark County District Attorney's Office.
I'm going to jump right in.
Okay.
I'm going to jump right in because I do have a lot of questions on issue two.
Sure.
Number one, you never subpoenaed this witness, correct?
That's
she was not subpoenaed.
We issued a subpoena. She was not served.
Okay, but you didn't technically subpoena her then. When you issue a subpoena, you mail it, whatever. She wasn't served with it, so she wasn't properly subpoenaed for trial, correct? She was not subpoenaed for trial.
I would say she was not. She was never served with her subpoena.
Okay. And you didn't seek a material witness warrant.
That's correct.
And you told the court that you were going to call the CAT team, but you didn't call the CAT team.
Correct.
Okay. So under what circumstances, on those facts, could you have even gotten in former testimony had she testified at a prelim and then here you are at trial? How would you have shown? Because it seems to me that the record is devoid of any efforts by the state's part to actively procure this witness. Nobody went under oath. Nobody said that they're going to get this witness. You wouldn't have even got this in on former testimony. So how did you get this rebuttal witness statement in your case in chief?
Yes, Your Honor. Justice. There are two different standards, though. Forfeiture by wrongdoing versus admitting testimony from a previous hearing. Those are two completely different theories of the case.
Why should we adopt the doctrine when you didn't actively seek a material witness warrant in this case? Because certainly the CAT team would do a lot more to pick up a witness than just somebody, whether it's a traffic warrant or PMP's warrant. Nobody's actively looking for anybody with a warrant unless you're actively looking for somebody. We have 3 million people here.
Well, Your Honor, it's a bad habit. Justice, we did have PMP looking for her. We did have detectives looking for her. We had my investigator looking for her. But regardless of that the Supreme Court standard, the Ninth Circuit standard for a forfeiture by wrongdoing isn't the attempt to procure, the state's attempt to procure. The standard as articulated by the Ninth Circuit is affirmative action on behalf of the defendant to get somebody not to appear, and then that actual result occurs. Right.
So I want to just piggyback on the direction you're going, separate from Justice Silver's comments. Part of the forfeiture concept is that the defendant intends that they not come and engages in some conversation, some action that does in fact cause them to be absent. The federal rule pretty much mirrors that. Intended to and did procure the absence of the witness. So here's the thing I need you to tie up for me. The woman had absconded from probation months, many months before. She had never been advised of a court date or her need to testify. And again, people are looking for her and can't find her. Under that theory, even absent a telephone call from the defendant, how can you say that she was ever going to appear at a date she didn't know about while she would probably be arrested on the courthouse steps? So I need the nexus tied up between the telephone call from the defendant and the absence, and I think that's where I'm struggling.
Sure, and I think part of that ties back to the question of when this phone call occurred, and I think a review of the record will show that the phone call occurred after the first day of trial. So it occurred on August 28th, 2017. It's a phone call after the state represented that intended to call the defendant's daughter. Now, the text of the phone call or the conversation says, you know, they know you need to disappear. I know they know where you are. They're tracking you by your phone. You need to turn off your phone, leave it at where you are, and go to some other person's house. And the primary way in which the state would find somebody through the use of CATS would be a precision pen based on the phone of the witness.
That's certainly not the only way the CAT team gets.
Sure, it's not the only way. It's definitely not the only way. I'm sorry if I made it sound like
that. It did sound like that.
But okay. Mr. Palal, the fact that you're tracking her and trying to find her, she wasn't coming to court. Are you telling me that she was coming before? So the defendant hadn't called her, she was showing up? And how would she know where and when?
What the defendant's statement did was cause us not to be able to find her by advising her to turn off her phone. It was, in fact, the only way we were going to be able to...
But you were going to use her as a rebuttal witness. You told the court at calendar call you were ready.
Yeah.
You have two witnesses, the victim and, right, and his other significant other.
Correct.
Already saying, this guy shot me in the face.
Correct.
You were going to use her as a rebuttal witness, but suddenly your investigator comes in the case in chief. Explain that.
Because after the phone call, after we get the phone call, which occurs when I make those representations, it's on the first day of trial. Then after the first day of trial, we get the phone call that says, don't show up, turn off your phone, disappear.
So it's a bad act. It's basically a bad act is what it is, that phone call. I mean, you certainly could have gone and indicted him on intimidating a witness. You could have had a whole new felony.
Right.
But it's now this bad act allows it in the case in chief?
The forfeiture by wrongdoing does, yes, Your Honor. That's the state's position. That the state is never tied to calling a witness either in its case in chief or rebuttal. It depends as long as we properly notice the witness. And there's no dispute that this witness was properly noticed. So it was up to the state to...
How was she properly noticed?
She was in our notice of witnesses. She was in our notice of witnesses. So it wasn't for the first time the state said, we're going to call her.
But you said you were going to call her as a rebuttal because you had to have believed that there was going to be an alibi and you were going to put her on with the investigator to then say, isn't it true that you told us, you know, that he shot him, right, the victim?
Right.
So you were only going to use her to impeach her anyway in a rebuttal case.
Well, that's not necessarily true, Your Honor, because when my investigator conducted the interview with her, we didn't know what she was going to testify to.
And did you promise her any benefits at that time? To get her out of custody?
We did.
If she cooperated?
We did drop the attempt murder with use charge, uh-huh, which caused her to go to...
And did all of that come out at trial?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so that, in fact, at the beginning of trial, prior to trial, one of the things that the defendant wanted was the actual record of what occurred. And Judge Leavitt had us give it, because some of that's private information or sealed information because she's a juvenile. So we gave it to the court. The court gave it to the defendant. The fact that the witness or the defendant called the witness and told her to turn off your phone, he's actively telling her different means to evade service, actively telling her different means to prevent us from finding her. And that's the policy behind forfeiture by wrongdoing, is that you don't get to benefit by your telling a witness not to show up or assisting a witness.
But aren't those in cases where somebody has been subpoenaed for a certain time certain in court, which never occurred here?
I don't believe that's necessary, right? I don't believe that's what the case law reflects, that the person actually had received a subpoena. In fact, as Justice Silver, you know, in domestic violence cases, right? You have a number of instances where...
A number? Almost all of them?
All of them where they don't actually accept service, and yet you can still, if there was a phone call where a defendant said, don't show up to court, you could still admit,
right,
that testimony based on...
Well, that's what you're asking us to do, because that's in almost every DV case.
Right.
In almost every DV case, you're getting a phone call from jail saying, don't show up. In almost 99 out of 100 of them, and what you're asking us to do then is to basically adopt a doctrine which allows that in a case in chief without actually ever procuring a witness.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, I think that's what Carlson versus AG of California stands for, the Ninth Circuit.
I'd like to interrupt,
yes,
the conversation and ask a question is a follow-on to the question I asked Ms. Rasmussen. It seems to me that the discussion that's taking place about the facts surrounding the missing witness, what she knew or didn't know, is an issue that would be resolved by the trial court when confronted with this doctrine. And so to me, the question is important. What standard of evidence did the district court apply in assessing this doctrine? A preponderance of the evidence or a clear and convincing evidence standard? Because it would seem like that standard would be important in assessing the consequences, even if you were going to recognize the doctrine in this case.
Yes. I believe the case law that we gave the trial court was Carlson v. AG of California, that's 791 F3D 1003. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit adopted the preponderance of evidence standard. And Carlson is kind of reflecting what happened in Giles v. California, it's dealing with a different issue, but in that, in the majority opinion, Justice Scalia goes through the history of forfeiture by wrongdoing quite extensively. And I think after analyzing the Giles case, the Ninth Circuit came to the conclusion that a preponderance of evidence is the proper standard when evaluating forfeiture by wrongdoing.
So even under a preponderance of evidence standard, assuming that that is the standard that the district court actually employed, what findings did the district court make that, to tag on to what Justice Stiglitz asked you, that the phone call singularly resulted or caused the deprivation of the witness to be present?
I don't think the case law, at least that the trial court was relying on, requires that it singularly causes a witness not to show up. The case law that it just that it produces a desired result, and I think contributing to the desired result, I think is sufficient because, again, the policy behind forfeiture by wrongdoing is that a defendant doesn't get a benefit from assisting or contributing to a witness not showing up to court. And I believe that was the trial court's determination upon listening to the phone call.
So your argument is that if this court were to recognize this doctrine consistent with Giles and Crawford versus Washington, the elements of the doctrine would be that the wrongdoing works to abrogate the right of a defendant to confront such a witness when the defendant, and these are the only elements that need to be shown, engages in wrongdoing with the intent of preventing the witness from testifying, and the witness is unavailable at the time of trial.
I would say
that's all you have to show the district court under Giles?
I would say that you would have to show that it contributed in some way by preponderance of evidence. I would not say that it happens not to, a person happens not to show up. I think there has to be some kind of contribution. I think in this case, the defendant telling the witness to leave and telling her to turn off her phone, I think, is contributing to her not being there. I don't think it has to be the sole cause. I don't think, this comes from common law as explained by Justice mm-hmm. Scalia, and I don't think that there's anything that says it has to be the sole cause or the sole motivation. I think that's an impossible standard to meet. So how could we possibly know what goes into somebody's head so why they didn't show up?
Your argument to the district court was whether she was going to, as suggested, she may not have been intending to show up anyway because she was already on the run, so to speak, but this call would have contributed to her absence.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Pillow, just yes. The next question.
Yeah, of course.
So let's say you do a preponderance or clear and convincing, whatever, the standard's met. Does the judge have, at that point, any gatekeeping function in terms of what statements actually go to the jury? So once you've established, yep, you were wrong and you caused in some fashion the witness not to come. Because in this instance, we had inculpatory statements, we had statements about photographs somebody else took without foundation, and we have statements rebutting an alibi that wasn't presented. So does the court have any independent obligation then to review those statements, or is it just kind of like forfeiture by wrongdoing, you forfeit everything?
No, I mean, I think that would be an absurd result, which is what I think you're getting at. I think certainly the evidence has to be relevant for it to come in. It's the same standard with any testimony that comes into before a jury, before a trier of fact. The testimony has to be relevant. The state's position is that the investigator's testimony regarding the statements by the daughter were, in fact, relevant. The fact that he's procuring or asking a witness to lie on his behalf, I think, certainly shows a consciousness of guilt. So regardless of whether that photograph comes in or not, the fact that he's suggesting to his daughter, you need to lie and say that I was at this place and I took this photograph and this is the proof of that, certainly in any other context would easily pass as being relevant as consciousness of guilt.
Should we look at a clear and convincing standard like Petrocelli? I mean, if this is technically another bad act, him intimidating a witness, which is another crime itself.
I think May I answer?
Sure. Okay.
I think that's two distinct questions. Whether or not the jail call comes in, I think, is arguably a Petrocelli issue where clear and convincing evidence needs to be met. Whether or not forfeiture by wrongdoing, the statements come in, which is different than the jail call coming in, it should be by preponderance of evidence, as the Ninth Circuit articulated. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I just want to follow up on a few of the questions that were asked. While the state is arguing that to make a determination that it was the sole factor in someone not showing up is, they're saying that that's too hard. Well, I think the converse is true with regard to it being a contributing factor. That's so vague, it could be contributing to anything. And in this case, none of this is analyzed. And I think as Justice Silver points out, or Justice Stiglitz points out, she was going to be called as a rebuttal witness to an alibi defense that wasn't presented. So in this case, it wasn't even relevant. It wasn't relevant, and there was no need to bring in testimony of something that wasn't even subject to cross-examination under oath in a prior proceeding. It was literally a statement. If the court adopts what the state is wanting them to do, there's going to be literally no need for the state to bother subpoenaing people in many cases. I mean, they say they issued a subpoena, but there was no attempt to serve it that they documented in this case. So for those reasons, I'd ask that you reverse for a new trial.
Well, but the Giles case doesn't seem to require that the state secure the presence of the witness. The Giles element simply says the witness is unavailable.
Can I answer?
Yes.
But here, I think the Giles case doesn't address the issue that we have here, Justice Hardesty, where the state didn't document what attempts it had made to secure the witness. And so my fear is that we run down this slope where the state can just say, hey, this witness probably isn't going to want to come anyway. Let's, wait and see if the defendant makes some affirmative act to discourage him, and then we can blame it on that, and then we can get in everything we want.
Okay. I don't think we have any other questions here in Carson City. Judge Silver.
All right. This time, then, thank you very much. This case stands submitted.
Thank you.
And we thank the attorneys for their arguments. Thank you so much.
We'll be in recess.